Back in 2014, after some work in Washington, D.C., our family took an afternoon trip to the Smithsonian Museum of American History. Sasha had just turned 4 and had loved all things Wizard of Oz for over a year. The movie got watched a lot. She had been given her own ruby slippers. I had read her the book with its silver slippers at age 2 and 3. And what did they have at the Smithsonian? The actual ruby slippers from the movie. So special. So we went. And at the same time, the museum was running a massive exhibit marking 150 years since emancipation in this country and 50 years since what we call the Civil Rights Movement. It was designed as an immersive walkthrough with history unpacked fluidly and directed at all ages and levels of understanding. Exhibits like the actual shackles that were used to chain up and bind the hands and arms of children. Children as young as 4-year-old Sasha. We walked through the exhibit, listening, learning, and talking. And the conversations continued on the drive home to Charlottesville, where we had just moved back. And we knew the statistics. We know that parents in white-identifying families in this country wait until their children are around 11 to 13 to talk about race and racial justice issues on average, if they do at all. These conversations tend to emphasize equality and how deep down we're all the same and just be nice, which remember is not the same as kindness, that everyone should be treated the same. And yeah, everyone should be treated all the same. And it's very likely that white parents, by and large, don't have all the language awareness or historical knowledge themselves to really unpack the state of things. It can be nerve-wracking to have to get into the thornier issues of the world. But two things happen with this approach. One is that it mainly serves to dissolve difference. That is, trying to create a mindset of, I don't see color, which, number two, invariably will lead to some kind of existential crisis for the youth in high school, college, or beyond, because this world definitely sees color. And that's just assuming that child is immersed in at least a piece of the real world. So the young person has a choice, coming to terms with the fact that, in fact, people are very much not treated equally based on the color of their skin or sexuality, gender, religion, etc. in this country, whether by individuals or policies, systems or cops. And they haven't been for the entire history of the United States and before that. And now the young white person is needing to play catch-up in developing language, muscles, and relationships that honor and serve others with honesty. Or, because it's easier and less vulnerable, they can maintain a cocoon of relative comfort without stepping out into troubling the waters towards that dream Dr. King had. Indeed, as King said, history is the long and tragic story of the fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Black and brown families, on the other hand, statistically have their first talk with their children about racial difference and injustice at around age 3 or 4. And emphasis on difference, as in you will be treated differently because of the color of your skin, as in so you need to behave differently than might feel natural, as in, oh, by the way, it's a matter of life and death. Some of you will know that an exceedingly tragic rite of passage for young black boys especially is getting the talk, capital T, namely how to avoid the police and what to do and not to do if you're ever stopped so that you can come home okay. These two approaches to racial consciousness, and therefore American consciousness, I don't think I need to tell you, are different. And as white identifying parents, I'm of European descent and Tracy's part Filipina, in a transracial family with a daughter of Liberian and Salvadoran heritage, we knew these stats and wanted to be committed at that young age for Sasha. But the thing about honest and hard conversations, especially with family, whether that's our family in the home or our family in the church, well, they inevitably lead and grow and stretch us to where new views and evolved perspectives, internal integrity, and relational commitment compel us, if we're being honest about those things, compel us to come and see. Jesus, where are you staying? Come and see. And where can we see the most? Well, if we're using our feet, on a mountaintop. But that's a hard trek. It requires those muscles be trained and then developed along the way, no matter how hard or deadly the going gets. And so it was that shortly after that Smithsonian visit, I found myself taking Sasha to the downtown library in my hometown of Charlottesville. The downtown library in Charlottesville is located right next to the public area, formerly known as Lee Park, but still home to a towering Jim Crow-era white supremacist Civil War participation trophy monument to Robert E. Lee. Yes, that park. Yes, that statue. And yes, that Charlottesville. And because our public symbols communicate story, because we valorize our values, and because this statue of Lee on his horse is enormous, and in Charlottesville's primary public square, Sasha, still 4 years old, naturally had questions. Questions I, in this body, had successfully avoided in myself in my kindergarten through college upbringing there. She asked, on the way to the library, "Who's that?" "Oh, well, you remember that war we were talking about and learned about at the museum, the Civil War, that ultimately led to freeing all the enslaved people? Well, he was a general in that army during that war." "Oh, so he fought for the side that fought to free the slaves, right?" Perfect kid logic, obviously, because there's a monument to him. "Well, actually, sweetie, so Virginia was one of the states that seceded, and that means they didn't want to be part of the United States anymore so they could fight to keep slavery going. And Robert E. Lee fought for that side to keep the slavery and for the Confederacy." There was a long pause. "So why is there a statue of him?" And I didn't have an answer. I didn't fully know the answer. And in that moment, I resolved not to be rendered speechless on this again, starting with family. My work, our work for community justice and community justice, our commitments, our relationships shifted into a new register in that moment. And in the following few years, we found ourselves growing in a beautiful new tapestry of Charlottesville community, committed to hard conversations, life-giving table fellowship, working to help the entire area come to terms with our history so that we could collectively grow forward honestly while honoring those lives that had historically and systematically been marginalized as mattering less. If you were here on my first Sunday, last August 11th, or have happened to Google Seth Wispelway to try to figure out more of what you got yourselves into, not many of you have. you'll know that this work, I'm not telling you to, you'll know that this work led to a traumatizing, fatal, and critical inflection point in the summer of 2017. A trauma for Charlottesville and for our country, and that one that I was in the middle of. We were working to impact and influence that time. But it was never about me or about any individual there. It was about following that call. It was about my own daughter, and then about my colleagues and comrades in confronting racism and fascism, my friends. It was about asking, who is Charlottesville for? Who is this country for? Not liking the answer we found, and writing a fresher, evolved, and honest story for collective growth forward. And yet that work, which on the surface at least was an honest conversation and work to remove this white supremacist idol, led to the largest white nationalist gathering in decades. And in the summer months preceding the Klan rally in July and the Unite the Right rally on August 11th and 12th, that work led to a lot of ostensibly progressive white folks, many of them Christians and faith leaders, to speak out against confronting the imminent threat of white supremacist gatherings, to speak out against shaking things up, that would be giving them what they want. Just ignore them and it will go away. This is not who we are. We're a comfortable, friendly, welcoming community. And you only make things worse. You'll incite violence by showing up to say otherwise. I want to read you something. It's not my words. We urge the public to continue to show restraint should the demonstrations continue, and the law enforcement officials to remain calm and continue to protect our city from violence. A cause should be pressed in the courts and in negotiations among local leaders and not in the streets. We appeal to both our white and Negro citizenry to observe the principles of law and order and common sense. That last line is probably a giveaway that this is not a quote from Charlottesville senior clergy, but sadly it's pretty close to what we heard from them. No, that's an excerpt from the letter written by the 8 Alabama clergymen, men, that King was responding to in his letter from a Birmingham jail. The faith leaders in Charlottesville, predominantly white, male, and Christian, who sounded verbatim like those Alabama clergymen when the stakes couldn't have been higher, are the same who would love to quote King 51 other weeks out of the year, just like you or I. Don't you see? Come and see. We are people of faith and conscience. Where else are we called when members of our community, in here and out there, where else are we called to the hard conversations and work when members of our community are angry and scared and hurt and confused? This was our response as organizers of the faith response to the Nazis. It's a pastoral call. We're called where the pastoral need is urgently crying out. The question is whether we are, all of us, grounded in openness like the disciples, who are willing and able to be grounded in a perspective that sees the marginalized as the rabbis and teachers among us, who ask where they're staying and drop everything when they say, come and see. What is church for if not to come and see what God is doing? What is Charlottesville for? What is church for if not to come and see what God is doing or is capable of doing when we bring our bodies and resources and our safe spaces to the fight for human dignity, equality, and belovedness? And believe you me, when we live that out in humility and presence and embodied solidarity with a plan, we will gain in community growth in this space. And this is where we found ourselves when my daughter said, in not so many words, come and see. Come and see what this statue looks like to me. And I saw. And I messed up plenty along the way. And my privilege always gave me the option to opt out. Still does. But the view kept changing the more we climbed towards that new story, up that mountain with those gatherings, with that interfaith service that brought in UCC leadership from around the country and Dr. Cornell West that we put on. And we knew King's dream could be made real even for a day in August if enough would just show up to tell it. And we knew we were risking the same violence as the Freedom Riders and the Birmingham Marchers and more. It's what happens when you start climbing God's holy mountain. When, like the disciples, you drop those things that obscure our view of God's dreams and come and see with Jesus. Now, here's some of King's response to those clergymen. A lot of you probably read it before. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish siblings. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers the way we've always done things, a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, of exploring church growth, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season, whatever that means. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. End quote. Who is the white moderate King is talking about? In modern parlance, I'd say it's the white progressive. So who's he talking about for us today? Most of y'all. There's nothing I could say that's stronger than what King or Jesus is going to say. But most of y'all, he's talking about most of those gathered here today. And I know this pricks and stings. And believe me, this is one of the least incendiary passages King I could have chosen. And remember when Jesus said those with wealth and worldly comfort would have a super hard time knowing him truly and finding a cross to pick up as his disciple? To relieve ourselves of most of all of our possessions? Yeah, he was also talking about most of us. There's no caveat to this. We wish there were. There just aren't. This is a hard conversation we all need to be having with one another, especially if we missed it at age 3 or 4 or 11. And it has direct implications and opportunity for our work as a church in an interim time. And remember, too, that King was kicked out of his own Baptist convention. I think it's something like 10% of churches in what we call the civil rights movement were actually on board with what was going on. We don't have to be risking life and limb in the streets to be discomfiting change agents to the status quo, or to be disciples who follow the Jesus path wherever he leads. We don't have to be risking life and limb in the streets to simply have evolving imagination and humility for what a radically welcoming and progressive church can be growing forward, especially in times like these. Though, as I've said before, we are going to need to be in the streets before November. Indeed, I believe simply having a building and a property like we have is a life-giving beacon for folks hungry for what we have the potential to offer. And spoiler alert, there actually are recipes for big boosts in attendance and membership from all ages. I've directly encountered the hunger and trust from those who want what could be offered in our UCC churches. What is church for? If we're postured towards church with a consumer mindset, then two things happen. What a church has to offer becomes a buffet for producer and consumer alike. And how one understands one's relation to church is focused on the self and what I'm getting out of it. What's my return on investment? And like all stock markets and buffets, even if we're not aware of it, we want a higher return than what we put in. More bang for buck. Load up on the chicken wings, less soup and salad. Or here's my pledge, now make sure I get my money's worth. Or rather, more than my money's worth. Or at least 60-minute services in the organ every week. We're at 61 now. Is this what church is for? As King is saying, actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action, trying to grow what's possible in the church, are not the creators of tension. I'm not the creator of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. Injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. End quote. Church is for community, for life together, as Bonhoeffer wrote. For a community that knows why it's a community. Knowing our why, our shared story, is what opens us up to honestly name, seek, and receive the healing, the hope, and the interrelational safe space that who we are needs. Why do we congregate? When we share in a story that we know together, then we receive abundant fruit that we need as individuals and can't get anywhere else. Church is for your needs. This is why we gather, or otherwise I'll be the first to tell you to find your soul food elsewhere. If you get it hiking Mount Lemmon or at brunch, then do that. What are we doing that's any different from any other churches that sets us apart, that gives you soul food here? I know a lot of things. And that's great. But I don't know that we're doing too much that's different from many other churches, and we wonder why people don't come or simply say that younger folks don't do or want church anymore, and that's untrue. You can also get a 60-minute service with organ and hymns elsewhere. This will be the longest sermon I ever give, don't worry. What sets Rincon apart? I wrote in this week's newsletter that around 55% of you named thriving relationships and increased participation across church life and leadership as the most important indicator of church growth here. I find that really encouraging. And not just because it was also the one question with over 50% agreement. I hope you find it encouraging too. I find it encouraging because I've observed and think that to be true, that will be a measure of our growth in the year ahead and into calling a new settled pastor. I think it's what Rincon not only needs, but wants when all is said and done, to see that growth of relationship and participation happen, as well as to keep the trappings of church, the liturgies, the music, the ministry opportunities and programs within a familiar and comfortable pattern for enhancing that growth for those who already call this church home. And if that's what y'all want, that's what we'll do. I've heard it. I'm here to reflect back. And listen, predominantly white churches, progressive, moderate, or conservative, most all say they want to grow in numbers and to diversify or be a light in their communities, and they want a leader who can organize and guide that. But white churches are all centered around white experience and comfort and our perspective by default. But to diversify in a variety of ways our offerings and our community, done honestly, is decentering and therefore deeply uncomfortable. I get it. Which we actually don't want. I'm saying in general. I'm not laying out a judgment on Rincon's final answer. But like as white folks, we don't want that. And aren't equipped for, and most faith leaders aren't either. They're too afraid to risk their paycheck and housing allowance. Not me. But listen, it's okay to lean into caring for one another as you are. I want you to hear this. Naming and owning that will give you the care that you seek and the services you want and the pastor who can provide them. It's a gift to just spend time with you. Most of y'all know that my favorite part of this work is spending time with y'all and just sitting over coffee and talking. It all starts with relationship. In whatever direction Rincon makes going forward, and whether we pick up our pastoral search process next month or next year, pastoral care will get us to the other side. Care with each other, not just from me. Care that holds our own anger, fear, confusion, and hurts honestly. Will we come and see what that's like? Will we extend that care to care for others who can carry this future forward? This kind of come and see discipleship that ultimately meets the folks who are most having their needs crushed underfoot. This discipleship is the white blood cell to the virus of our white fragility and privilege. I hope we're not immune. And for churches seeking a settled pastor, as your interim, I'm here to help you call who you need and want. But wherever that leads and whatever you remember from my time with you, you know that in the end we can't escape the past and our choices there. We must deconstruct and examine and learn from and talk about our process with integrity and gospel specificity. It will cost, but in the most liberating of ways. You can find plenty of social clubs on Sundays and other days. What sets Rincon apart? What's worth keeping going beyond the next 5 to 10 years? And 5 to 10 years is this church's current expiration date if things maintain as they are. That's okay, too. Institutions close down and don't want to gasp in perpetuity. I just want to be honest about the writing on the wall. And now social clubs aren't bad, per se. Let's just please not pretend Jesus is leading our search and growth process if we aren't open to risking the comforts and familiarity of our very white institution here when it exists in a white supremacist society that privileges our churches and privileges us for attending them. That's not freedom of religion. That's co-opting so we can feel good about a selective vanilla Martin Luther King, so we can maintain a comfortable Christ. Remember, the empire wants us civil, wants us to maintain order and keep a flag up, doesn't want us in the streets or messing around too much, wants us dealing with migrants on ICE's terms and the Border Patrol's terms. But remember, power, and especially death-dealing power, never gives up without having its hand forced. So surely, many of us like to think we're on board with King's Birmingham letter and love and admire the man and the work he did, which was, like everything, actually built on a movement led by black women at the grassroots level. Surely we like to think we'd agree in real time with the civil rights movement. But the truth is, our lives say to those crying out now, January 2020, assuming we have ears to hear them, our lives say to them, let's take our time, wait, you're being too pushy, too much change too soon. This is not how we've done things, and I'm leaving and taking my money out of this buffet. My job is to challenge y'all. I don't relish that, but I also lost so much sleep this night, this past week, trying to say anything other than what the call I felt was with the scripture and this weekend. So, am I being unfair or untruthful? Nope. Did you hate this sermon? If nothing else for the length, that's okay. That's a helpful piece of information to have for the process ahead about what you want the church to be growing forward, so you're welcome. Believe me when I say that I will walk with you on the road of maintaining what our median population, age, and most active voices want. We just need to honestly name where that will ultimately lead so we can get going on that process. And even if Rincon does end up with closed doors within the decade, that doesn't mean that life won't be sowed here between now and then. Life and love are made manifest every week you all come and gather and remain open to saying yes when Jesus says, come and see. I've experienced it in every conversation with you. In book club, prep and pastry, Sunday mornings are my favorite. When you cook for those experiencing homelessness, etc. This is just a building, a property. Jesus is walking by regularly. When someone calls out, look, here is the Lamb of God. Did we follow? Do we? Will we? Even if Jesus keeps walking on by and it's a new path, come and see. Notice that John says the Lamb takes away the sin of the world. Now, the sin here, singular in the Greek, is not something bad you did for Jesus to snatch away if you pray hard enough. No, John's use of sin emphasized the world's collective alienation from God and one another. This isn't a fundamentalist catalog of human sins. This person is taking away our alienation from one another. Come and see. Hear me on this. To be white is not sinful. But passively or actively maintaining white supremacy and privilege and whiteness is an alienating sin. To not collectively work towards knowing what our church is for alienates us from one another. I want to work with y'all to figure out what our church is for and hear what you want and help sew it together. But if we just have opinions without reaching across to one another, that's alienating. Let's solve for what we want. It causes us to lash out at items in the buffet that we don't like otherwise. Or when we feel like our investment in stock here isn't paying returns for us. Like when the sermon goes too long. Come and see what's possible when you come to the table with King, with Jesus, with the disciples. You will find your way forward and I will be with you. And I'm going to close, collective sigh. I'm going to close with the close of King's mountaintop speech. I am not the I here. I am not equating myself with King at all. I'm going to read it, though, and I'm going to say that I feel these words. And do you? Have you been to the mountaintop? Are you ready for April 4? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't much matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And God's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know today that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. and I'm happy today. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Jesus said to King, come and see. And he saw, and he lived it. Jesus says to y'all, come and see. And they, amen.